So you might think that a luxurious episode outside on location shooting featuring Janeway and an actor playing Leonardo da Vinci on adventures would be something I would hate, and you would be absolutely correct.
Okay, so this is what I imagine Doctor Who to be.
Pretty much, yes.
I mean, listen, I like John Rhys-Davies' voice. I think he does a fine Leonardo da Vinci. And, you know, it's just... I have a lot of very academic style notes on this episode, let's put it that way. This is not going to be a passionate discussion from my end.
Well, I will be very interested to hear your academic discussion about this episode, because I really don't have much passion for this episode either. I think that the problem with Concerning Flight is it really, 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 really hinges on whether or not you are fascinated, engaged with, charmed by the portrayal of Leonardo da Vinci by John Rhys-Davies. And while it is a fine portrayal, I fundamentally do not care. I don't really find this sort of historical play acting to be interesting. And the entire conceit of a holodeck character that gets stolen and then put into the real world, interpreting everything he is seeing through the eyes of a holodeck character, just strains my... I mean, I've got a lot of... I can strain my believability here for Star Trek a lot of the time, but just something about this episode, I just can't quite get that far.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are a lot more... The basic premise of this episode, that there is a planet that steals tech and they're trying to get it back and they've stolen the computer, I feel like there are a lot more interesting angles into that episode. And I feel like... I mean, the relationship between Leonardo and Katerina is fine in small doses. Like, a little kind of does go a long way, right? Like,
I might disagree with you about that, but sure, continue.
Well, you know, for any use of the holodeck, right? Like, I tend to like the holodeck when it's, you know, a couple minutes. It gives a character a different angle in which to discuss their problems. I really liked, for example, the scene with Seven of Nine and Janeway when they're working on the statue together. You know, that's a conversation, that's an action that they can't do anywhere else. And
sure.
For Leonardo to be somebody which is going to help Janeway talk out her problem, who is going to phrase things in a metaphor that she doesn't, you know, this is whether or not we agree with her decision, for example, to ally with the Borg in Scorpion, to make that deal with the devil, that is not a metaphor that she would consider unless she were talking to Leonardo. And I guess that is a argument against the practice, but that's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, I joke, but I kind of agree with you. I mean, I think that it does work in small doses. I don't have a problem with it. I mean, this style of storytelling or this device is not one of my favorites. I didn't really like it when TNG did it. DS9 never really did it, if I'm mistaken, please tell me, but I don't think they did.
What about I forget his name, the nightclub singer.
Yeah, but that wasn't a real person.
No, and that is fair.
I mean, certainly that's arguable, but I don't know. How can you not like Vic Fontaine? But I think if that had been Frank Sinatra, that would have wore out its welcome very quickly.
That is a fair point.
But so I fully admit that I do not like this style of storytelling. But, you know, whatever. I mean, I have to criticize things, you know, on a fair basis without my own personal likes or dislikes necessarily getting into it. Although, why are you listening to this podcast otherwise? It's always a fine line to walk. But just expanding out this to an entire episode just does not work. And I'm not quite sure why. I don't know if it's because the stakes don't feel real. I don't know if it's because Leonardo da Vinci doesn't feel real. I don't know if it's because he feels too real. I don't know. And I think that there's really something to be said for the rubber band nature of the holodeck, where holodeck characters, like, you apparently, I mean, Tuvok says in this episode that the Leonardo da Vinci holodeck character has all of Leonardo da Vinci, the real Leonardo da Vinci's genius, because the holodeck created it. And this raises a very sort of like horrifying existential question in my mind, which is that can you just like recreate historical people and just have them around to help you out? This seems like a really, really terrible episode of Black Mirror or something.
Well, and let me ask you this. Historical features is bad enough, but can you create a holodeck picture of somebody you knew who died? Can we have a, you know, could we have a holographic suitor? Could Neelix create a holographic sister? You know, this is, if you're going to go to historical figures, why not go to loved ones?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's a really good point. I mean, certainly it's Leonardo da Vinci because it's fun and everyone loves a good John Rhys Davies appearance. And, you know, it makes sense for Catherine Janeway, of course. She's a scientist. She's someone who would enjoy spending a lot of time with someone like da Vinci because they're both very curious about the world and they've got this sort of wry sense of humor and all of these sort of things. And so, yeah, whatever, that makes sense. It's very different from the 24th century environment she lives in, so it's refreshing in that sense. So that part of it I don't really have an issue with, but it just... there's something about it that just strains what I can believe to say that, you know, these aliens, I mean, the episode starts out fine. I think that the idea of aliens that are essentially mugging other spaceships and stealing their technology to fund some sort of, you know, galactic black market or planetary black market is interesting. And I like that concept, but the episode doesn't do anything with it. And it turns into a really sort of half-assed costume drama, and I don't care about it.
I mean, I feel like if you had Picard or Sisko in this situation, they're immediately going to get extremely worried about their tech being in someone else's hands. Now, the Voyager crew is certainly worried about what are we going to do without our computer, without the holo emitter and stuff like that, but they don't seem to really worry about the shift in the balance of power for this quadrant, which Federation tech might do. Now, maybe it is simply because this is obviously a post-warp civilization. They obviously do have a lot of advanced tech, which if it's not quite, you know, let's assume there is a parity, you know, somehow. But I don't know. Like, don't you think seem to think that's more of a problem than they think it is?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think that's a fine argument against the episode. I think that at least maybe there should have been a throwaway line like, oh, well, we don't need to worry about it because whatever reason, you know, or maybe it could be going down the road of Voyager starting to realize that, frankly, they can't worry about that sort of thing because they're not in a position to worry about that sort of thing because they are one ship in a very hostile part of the galaxy that is just trying to get home. And they can't act like they're in Starfleet, so let's not worry about it. But that's not the show. So I agree. Well, leaving that aside, leaving aside Katarina and Leonardo da Vinci's adventures on the planet, there are a couple of character moments in this episode that I appreciate. I mean, Seven and Harry Kim have progressed from Harry Kim has a secret crush on Seven of Nine to Harry Kim being uncomfortable around Seven of Nine and Seven of Nine fucking with him, which I don't know if necessarily you would have thought that would be the direction the show would go in, but I like it.
Yeah, no, I'm happy with it. I don't think Seven of Nine is doing it because of... she's not doing it to amuse herself in the same way we would do it for her, but I think Harry Kim annoys her, and, you know, certainly she's happy to intimidate him. You know, she likes having him under control in that way.
I don't know if it's control. I think that...
you know, he listens to what she tells him to do, and, you know, that's fine. That helps her for her purposes. You know, not, again, not in a sinister way, but, you know, he's going to help it. And so, okay, you know, do this way and do this now, you know?
Yeah, certainly. But do you think that falls into a dangerous trope of overbearing women that are henpecking men?
If it weren't Harry Kim, it might be. But on the other hand, it's just like, let's put it this way. We don't take Harry Kim seriously. 7 of 9 isn't even beginning to take Harry Kim seriously. And so, all right, he's another set of hands. He's not going to fuck it up too much. Decompile those bits. Do it, Harry Kim.
I feel so bad for Harry Kim.
Yes! I know. It's listen. Now he's one of people's sexiest people. You don't have to feel bad for him.
Well, Garrett Wang is, and let me put it another way. I guess I feel bad for Garrett Wang. I don't necessarily feel bad for Harry Kim, because Harry Kim is not a real person. But Garrett Wang, I've seen him at conventions. He's very effusive. He's very engaged. He loves the fans. He's always happy and in a good mood. He has aged extremely well. I don't think that he really had much to do on the show. And I think that I don't know, like, Harry Kim always gets, like, ignored. And I think that it's becoming an in-joke in the show. Like, I don't know if they're putting Harry Kim in these situations with 7 of 9 because they think that Garrett Wang and Jennifer Lean, and Jerry Ryan have chemistry together, or if they're doing this because they like fucking with Harry Kim.
I mean, it could be both. They have good fucking with Harry Kim chemistry,
but not good fucking Harry Kim chemistry.
Well, no, because he's in love with Tom Paris. I wonder if it's a simple case of Garrett Wang just not being the meatiest actor to pull things off. I don't know.
Jonathan Frakes isn't the meatiest actor either, and he did fine.
Jonathan Frakes is good at hamming things up when he needs to. And, you know, a lot of Riker's acting is hamminess. And I think he pulls that off very well. You know, Riker gets a lot of big scenes.
I could go with that. I think that's a good way to look at it. What also makes me realize that, and this is kind of a side tangent, but one of the things that I think makes the Voyager cast feel a little flatter than a lot of the TNG cast is that a lot of the TNG cast had very specific ways that they had their characters move their body or body language that I don't really think a lot of the Voyager cast does. I mean, certainly Janeway does, 7 of 9, Neelix does, of course, but like Harry Kim, Tom Paris, even B'Elanna, I just think they're kind of flat all the time.
No, I think that's a fair way of putting it. You know, certainly Riker has a lot of very specific movements to talk to him. And again, you know, another thing about Jonathan Frakes is he and Patrick Stewart work really well together. They do have a very good, you know, chemistry there. Patrick Stewart is, of course, the focus of their scenes together, but Frakes is really good at playing off of that and being, you know, the secondary character in those scenes. And, I mean, I think Garrett Wang is good at playing the second character in the scenes with Jerry Ryan.
Right. Yeah, I think that what you said a couple of episodes ago still holds. If Harry Kim was not inexplicably a member of the main cast, and if he was just sort of a random guy that appeared every now and again, like an O'Brien type, his scenes in these episodes would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, it would be, okay, the one Harry Kim scene, like, we need to fill up 5 minutes and, you know, let's give Garrett Wang a steak dinner kind of a thing.
But then, like, I don't understand why they wanted to keep paying Garrett Wang as a full-time cast member. Like, they could have just broke his contract and had him come in as a day player if they wanted him in the show still. I don't get it, but whatever.
Yeah.
These are questions for Rick Berman, and, you know, maybe at some point he'll talk to us. We have not asked Rick Berman to talk to us. The other thing that I want to talk about with this episode is the Doctor in 7, because
I loved their scene.
Yeah, and this is going somewhere. I think not for any particular reason. This was not specifically the start of anything, but I think you can see that they have some interesting chemistry together.
Well, I mean, again, I love pretty much every scene the Doctor's been in. I love that he's just so thirsty for gossip and she's so bad at giving gossip to him. But it's interesting that that scene is followed not that long after by Seven saying, you know, why are you calling it Leonardo da Vinci? It's a hologram. Why would you refer to a hologram by name? And although there is no name to the Doctor is his name, and she doesn't, you know, she has not, I've never gotten the sense that Seven thinks less of the Doctor than she does of anybody else, right? Like, she only vaguely notices everybody else around her as it is, so, and she's giving the Doctor the same attention.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, no, it does make sense, and I think that what you're seeing there is, and I agree with you that it's an inconsistency, but I think it's an inconsistency in the way that Voyager is handling holograms, not in the way that Seven is necessarily reacting to them, because I don't think the show is equipped to have Seven question the reality of the Doctor's existence, and I also don't think the show is willing to or willing to go to that place of having Seven question the existence of holograms in general, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I also think that to a degree the Doctor is a very different hologram. I mean, he is a member of the crew. He is somebody that has worked with her a lot. I mean, it could even, you know, I think that inconsistency might exist in her. It might not be a major point of contention or everything, but just because she's much more familiar with it, he is a little more than Leonardo is, right? Like, he is self-aware in the way that Leonardo is not. Let's face it, Leonardo doesn't really understand where he is. He hasn't been around long enough to have developed the same sentience that the Doctor has developed at this point. Because again, the Doctor has had an arc where he started off as just, you know, state the nature of the emergency and has now gone to question his own existence and gone on to have a more or less full-time reality.
Yeah, certainly. But I think that, and maybe this is another reason why this episode doesn't work for me, is that it raises a lot of really troubling questions for me around the sentience or sapience of these holograms, that it is not in any way, shape, or form prepared to discuss, interrogate, or answer. And to me, I look at this and I say, okay, well, what is the difference between the Doctor and Leonardo da Vinci? Or frankly, what is the difference between Leonardo da Vinci and Moriarty from TNG, for instance, where it seems like the only Leonardo da Vinci as a hologram character is able to create, is able to, you know, invent new things, is able to, you know, give Janeway advice and have his own sort of like life and do these really sort of creative things. And yet, you know, Tuvok says that he was created to have all of Leonardo da Vinci's genius and have all of Leonardo da Vinci's personality and his intellect and all of these things. And yet there's some sort of leash or collar on him that is causing him not to realize that this alien planet is not America. They're trying to square a circle here that I have problems with.
Yeah, because I almost, you know, they keep saying he's trying to talk about this in 16th century terms, but he doesn't know what the fuck America looks like, right? Like, it could look like this, you know? He is able to kind of understand what everything is as they explain things.
Come on,
to
Leonardo
him.
Da Vinci is not a fucking moron. He would not think that they had ray guns in America.
I don't know. Fair enough, you know, but but at the same time, he's seeing this stuff and he's not, you know, his mind isn't exploding. He's just kind of saying, wow, I'm seeing a lot of really strange shit. In America, there's a lot of strange shit. Look at all the strange shit they have in America. I mean, that's kind of as they go for it. What do you... What would it's not like he's going to scream at everything.
Maybe that would have been more interesting.
Yeah, actually, that may have been a proper episode. I guess the only thing I really liked was the ending when they are flying off on the flying machine and it's working. The prince and his henchmen, like, give up at that point, and they just kind of have this, like, what the fuck look at that? Because, like, I don't know. I found that very funny. Like, at some point they realize, like, they're just, like, gliding off on this thing. Like, we're done. They've won.
Yeah, I do kind of like that. And they're only going probably about 10 miles an hour. But, hey, whatever.
Yeah, I know. Like, they could have caught it, but they're just, like, they're so perplexed by it.
I guess that's really what it comes down to, is, like, this is a completely stupid, unobjectionable episode. And it's just kind of like, all right, sure.
Yeah. You know, it's, again, some episodes are going to be filler episodes, and this was a filler episode, but we got John Rhys Davies hamming it up as Leo, and the implication is that this is the end of that character, that he's going off to Paris, and we won't see him again, so, you know, if that's the case, I'm not upset.
Well, there you go. All right, well, let's move on to Mortal Coil. But before we do that, I just want to take an opportunity to remind everyone listening to this that this podcast is listener supported. We do very much appreciate any donation that you would make. If you would like to do so, please go to patreon.com/trekaboutshow and give now. So Mortal Coil seems to have remembered the events of Jor-El, and I like this episode, but I'm also not sure it really makes any sense with Neelix's character development.
And, you know, here's the thing. It remembers the events of Jor-El. It remembers Chakotay's peyote machine. It has some deep cuts of continuity, but it doesn't remember emanations. Like, I kept waiting in this entire episode for Harry Kim to say, you know, I died and I came back. You know, so now he didn't die for... Exactly. But... Like, there is another character on the ship who Neelix can talk to about this, who has some kind of perspective on this, and the episode doesn't go into that, and that really felt like a miss.
I actually think that's a really good point, and it's not one that I thought about, frankly, because I forgot that Emanations was an episode, and I think probably I forgot about it for the same reason that Brian Fuller forgot about it. That's not to say that it was right for him to forget about it, because he was paid to write this episode and I wasn't. But yeah, that is the case, that I think that maybe the episode would have been the stronger for it. I don't know, though, because where would that have fit in? Like, I think that you go one of two ways with that in a certain sense. Then you either say, okay, well, the episode is going to go in the direction of having Neelix and Chakotay have a spirit quest together, or it's going to go in the direction of Harry Kim and Neelix having philosophical conversations about the nature of death. And I don't think you can have both of those in the same episode.
I mean, I don't think both of them contradict each other. And I also think this further would. I don't think that Neelix would take Harry Kim's views on it too seriously, just because we have not known Harry Kim to be somebody who has had faith. I mean, Chakotay is the person who is of faith, and I think the episode is, how do you hold on to your faith in the face of evidence of nothingness? For Neelix to have had a near-death experience or a death experience and coming back and thinking that, oh, this belief that I've had for my entire life is not the case. There is nothingness after death. I think that's kind of where Harry Kim, as a Starfleet person through and through, has always kind of been, right?
Yeah, like, certainly. I mean, I agree with you, but I'm not really sure where you're going with this, because that would be a very different episode, and that's not the episode that we have here. So, like,
I want a different episode.
I mean, that's fair. I mean, I think that I would have, I kind of reacted that way to Concerning Flight, and I think I would have preferred to have a different episode. But, like, this episode is all about the power of faith over evidence, and it's all about the ways in which, you know, Chakotay is the most spiritual person on the ship, is helping Neelix through this dark period of his, you know, the collapse of his faith. And I certainly think it would be an interesting episode to have Harry Kim, Neelix, and, say, a holographic representation of Richard Dawkins sit around and talk about the futility of faith, but that's not what Brian Fuller wrote, so I'm not really sure that we can have a cogent discussion about it.
Well, then we won't. Goodbye.
But yeah, I mean, like, that's true, but what would you... I don't know. I don't want to discount your
No. I guess, again, it's more, and maybe maybe there was a draft of the episode that had a discussion with a scene with Harry Kim, and it was cut out for exactly that same reason. Again, it's just this is an episode with some deep cuts, but one that to me seemed very obvious that was not talked about. Again, he's not the first person to come back to life. Yes, sure, he is the first person to come back to life after this amount of time.
Maybe there would have been time in this episode for Harry Kim and Neelix to have a brief discussion about it, for instance, at the party.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I died once and I came back. Oh, were you dead for 19 hours? No, but I came back. Okay, so I was dead for 19 hours and all of my faith is crumbled. Goodbye, Harry Kim. Like, develop a character. Like, that's all that, like, it we really needed, I think.
You basically just want everybody to be a dick to Harry Kim.
I think that's the show that I actually want, yes.
So leaving that aside, and I think it's a good point, what did you think of the ways in which Mortal Coil developed its character and its story? Because I like it, although I think that it's extremely unpleasant to watch.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. This is a character that we like, who is the character who makes everybody happy, and now that he's at loose ends, a lot of, you know, most of the people can't really figure out how to help Neelix. You know, there is no Neelix for Neelix.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's really the point of the episode, isn't it? That Neelix is the character that fixes everything for everybody, mm-hmm. and when Neelix is broken, there's no one to fix him.
But, you know, I mean, what I think it matters that everybody tries, you know, certainly, Chakotay is the big driver in trying to help Neelix, and even Ensign Wildman and her kid are trying to be something very grounded for Neelix. I ship the two of them, by the way, Ensign Wildman and Neelix now. That's a thing I do.
You got to do something on these cold, dark winter nights.
Listen, it's a very long time and these episodes aren't. You know, even Seven of Nine has her input into thoughts of immortality and all of that. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, there's
a lot of directions that we could take this conversation, yeah. but maybe the easiest one to dispense with is Ensign Wildman and her daughter, because, you know, it is an interesting choice for the show to bring this back, and I think maybe the brief mention of Ensign Wildman in one of last week's episodes or the week before was seeding the return of Ensign Wildman. I don't know if this was Brian Fuller's idea. I don't know if this was someone else's idea. I don't know if the actress was unavailable for a while and then suddenly became available again. You know, that's a thing that happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting choice to bring her back. Yeah. I think it's an interesting choice to, you know, now introduce this 3-year-old child into the mix. I also think it's a really interesting choice to have Neelix be her godparent that I'm not sure that we knew before.
Well, was he explicitly her godparent? Because it just seems like he's the only one who, you know, he's the one who's the most willing to tuck her in at night, you know, again.
He said it, so I would assume yes. But
well, there we go.
But yeah, I mean, like, it is the case that it make, like, I don't know why they brought her back, but it makes sense once you see it. And maybe that's why they brought her back.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to see her again. I mean, maybe we will or won't. If she was just brought back for this episode to be the because in this episode she is the vehicle for that childlike faith that Neelix has always had and that suddenly he's unable to get to, and you know, part of this is I think part of Neelix's journey in this episode is recognizing that maybe it doesn't matter what he knows to exist after death or not. That in a way, his role as the morale officer, as the person who has put it upon himself to help everybody have an easier time, he's got to pretend, right? Like, it doesn't matter whether or not he believes that the Great Forest exists. This little girl is scared and the Great Forest comforts her. And that's the value of it, you know? It's in a way, it's like, you know, explaining why the lie of Santa Claus.
Yeah, certainly. But I also think it helps to underscore exactly how much Neelix is yeah. hurting and damaged from this experience. And, you know, I think that, I don't know, there's something about the way in which Ethan Phillips plays Neelix after he comes back to life. And I mean, let's not forget, I mean, Neelix has been a character who's been beat the fuck up. I mean, in a certain yeah. sense, he's the O'Brien of Voyager. Like, yeah. you know, he got his lungs stolen. He was joined with Tuvok in a weird, you know, horrible body horror amalgamation that was subsequently murdered. You know, he has been killed and brought back to life and had his faith shaken. You know, this is a character that the show likes to abuse in some respects. And this is another episode where Neelix is abused. And I don't necessarily question the impulse because it's really good drama, but I'm not, and I think also in some respects it makes sense that it's Neelix because this is the character that you don't necessarily expect yeah. this sort of darkness from. I mean, he tries to kill himself at the end of the episode. Yeah. Chakotay essentially talks him down from jumping off the Empire State Building. And it all works. I mean, Ethan Phillips, you know, I don't know that he's like a super dynamic actor, but he pulls off a lot of stuff in these episodes that I think is really, really nice.
I mean, he's good at playing Neelix, I would say.
Well, he's good at playing Neelix, but he's good at playing a Neelix that is both really happy-go-lucky and a Neelix that is really depressed.
Yeah, I mean, what I think was interesting is the scene when he is at the Christmas, you know, party. And he's, you know, trying to, you know, and he's trying to play off that he's just messed up about this. And, you know, he's just like, oh, well, you know, have fun, everybody. Ha ha ha. Christmas, you know, and, you know, trying not to let anybody notice. And it almost makes me wonder how much of his time normally is spent kind of fronting in that way, because, as you know, and. You know, let's put other stuff onto the abuse thing. You know, Kes, who was his girlfriend and best friend, is now gone. And where is she? Like, he doesn't really have anybody to, you know, kind of talk to one-on-one now.
Well, he says that in this episode, right? I mean, yeah. He says that he basically lost his confidant in Kes when they broke up and then when she left the ship. I mean, I think the implication there is that, you know, they continued yeah. some sort of friendship even after they ended their relationship
relationship. Different, yeah. How many days is, you know, it makes me wonder the days that, you know, we see Neelix and he only has two lines, you know, in the mess hall. Was that maybe just a depression day for Neelix?
He's quietly sobbing.
I mean, it's just the Talaxian spices.
Yeah, Neelix's tears are actually why all the food tastes so terrible. Because
oh my god, it makes sense.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, I think that Neelix is a character who actually is a lot darker once you start scratching the surface of the character, and you know. It's weird because I remember saying a while ago that Voyager had seemed to have forgotten about the backstory of the Talaxian, Hakonian War, and, you know, of the events of T'Trell and Neelix's tragic backstory and how he felt he was a coward and his entire family died and his sister died and his uncle died and his mother died and his god brother died and everyone died, you know.
That whole list of that Tuvok is giving, you know, you're my brother, my sister. The brother of my father, the sister of my father, the sister of the brother of my
yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can just see Neelix doing that over and over again. And you know, that is a terrible backstory. And I think that we talked about at the time that Neelix would be a person who had a lot of PTSD and a lot of triggers and would not be a satisfied person, and that a lot of his happy go lucky nature is a cover for, you know, some really severe psychological trauma and disorder that he has. But the show mostly forgot about that, though. And then to bring it back again seems weird.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that is how trauma goes, though. I mean, it goes in cycles. You have your trauma and then you start to get over it. You get into your routine. You know, he is in a place where even though, you know, his biggest confidant is gone. Everybody pretty much likes Neelix, you know. Everybody enjoys him. Even B'Elanna likes him to a degree, even though she won't admit it. Even Seven of Nine is starting to warm up to him, and things are okay most of the time. And then, you know, you accidentally die for 19 hours, and then your support system just kind of crumbles and isn't enough. And, you know, he's going to build it up back up again, but I think one of the, you know, this is reminding me, one of the interesting things in this episode is towards the end when he's talking to Chakotay in the transporter room, part of the implication of why this realization that the Great Forest may not exist has shaken him so much, it's only so much for himself, it is even more for the sake of his family, right? Like, his family was killed in a meaningless, stupid war. His family was bombed to death, and, you know, they all died. You know, his poor sister died young, you know, before she was able to really live. And the one solace that he had is that, well, at least they're in heaven, right? Like, at least they're not completely gone. At least they're able to have an existence that is meaningful and important. And now the realization that, no, they are just gone. And, you know, he's weeping, he's feeling sorry for not only for himself, but for the waste of Elixia.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that, I mean, the weird thing is, too, though, that it kind of butts up against the envisioning of Starfleet and the envisioning of the Federation and sort of this you know, secularness that has permeated the culture that, you know, Starfleet, yeah, and Janeway and the Federation is a group of people in a society that really does believe in science and progress. And, okay, you can bring someone back to life after being dead for 19 hours. Sure, why wouldn't you do that? And it doesn't seem to occur to anyone, least of all Janeway, who makes the decision that, you know, the health of the body and the health of the mind are not the only things that are, yeah, important, and that, you know, no one seemed to really remember that Neelix had this spiritual belief, and we don't know how seriously he discussed it with anybody, right? I mean, he may never have really discussed it with anybody. They may just think, oh, it's a nice story and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, but I don't think that anyone really understands exactly how much solace Neelix does take in the story of the Great Forest, as you said. And to not even have that come into Janeway's head as a point of data in making this decision is interesting, because it really does speak to a fundamental, yeah, incompatibility between, you know, the two cultures. And I mean, I think Neelix is going to be okay. This is not a show where he is going to, I don't know, start cutting himself or something. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, yeah, in some ways this reminded me of the episode, again, you compared him to O'Brien. It reminded me of the episode where O'Brien's in the prison for, you know, the 75 years, and then it was only 5 minutes of real time, and, you know, having to deal with that, having to deal with the existential crisis and the traumas after that.
Right. And that episode was so interesting, though, because, you know, that was, you know, telling the story from a flashback perspective. And so you really did get to have an understanding that O'Brien was going through a process of treatment and coming to terms with this.
Yeah.
You know, but Neelix is doing this in real time, and it's a different situation, of course, but the yeah, I guess the storytelling impulses are similar there.
Yeah, and also let's not forget that there are no counselors on this ship. At least O'Brien had counselor access, you know, and Chakotay is certainly acting in that role as spiritual advisor, and this is a spiritual crisis, but he doesn't have a therapist to talk to about this.
Yeah, certainly. Because I think too that the other key scene there is the argument that Neelix gets into, or it's not even really an argument, because I don't think that Seven of Nine is arguing with Neelix. I think that Neelix is just essentially yelling at her. You know, when he has his little meltdown, and this is before, I think it's right before he goes, yeah, to kill himself, and, you know, he says, hey, you know, this is you had no right to do this. And, you know, how did you know, you didn't think about the implications, and I was dead, and you took away the Great Forest for me, and all these things. And Seven of Nine is sort of bewildered by this, because she has no conception of the afterlife. But it's such an interesting scene, because Neelix so rarely gets a chance to, I think, be the driver of a scene's emotionality. And yeah, that scene works really well.
Oh, yeah. yeah, from Seven of Nine's perspective, you know, he was broken. His functions are diverse. He's an important part of the crew. And yes, bring him back, you know, for his own sake, sure, but also for the crew's sake. And, you know, even Janeway is able to adopt that view a bit. You know, that seems to be her reasoning for doing this because, you know, but let me put it this way. Even if somebody had told Janeway, well, what about his belief in the Great Forest? You know, I think her response would have been, well, he's had a nice visit, but, you know, he'll be there for good eventually. But, you know, right now we need him. If
yeah.
if there is a chance to bring him back, it is the imperative is to bring him back, right? Like if you as a doctor have the opportunity to cure somebody, it's your responsibility. You know, that's the point of the Hippocratic Oath. You are supposed to try and cure this.
Yeah, or cure the body at least. I mean, the mind is up to somebody else. Well, so, and I guess maybe the last thing to talk about then is just briefly touch on, you know, the reemergence of Chakotay's Uchimoya and his little medicine bag and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, this is something we have not seen for a while. And I think that you know, Star Trek Voyager is generally a show that will forget about things and then bring them back. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just that's the way the show functions. And I think it works fine. I mean, I think that Chakotay serves a really good purpose in this episode. You know, Robert Beltran does a pretty good job, and he moves on. And I think that, you know, it's the fact of the matter that that point, I think, is to get Neelix to that point of having that really creepy fucking vision of his terrifying sister.
Yeah.
And to show that, I mean, because really he didn't discuss that with Chakotay. Chakotay tried to get him to discuss it with him, and he tried to say, hey, you need to do this. This was part of our agreement. And Neelix doesn't want to do it. And Chakotay is usually a person who is a little more empathetic than that. And I think that the one thing I wish would have happened in that scene would have been for Chakotay to say, you know, what you might have seen might have been scary or terrifying or upsetting in some way, and it's okay. And there doesn't seem to be a realization on Chakotay's part that that could have happened.
Well, I think it's a blind spot on Chakotay's part, because at the end he does say, like, yeah, it you know. Obviously, to Neelix, Neelix sees this, he thinks the spirits are telling him to kill himself, and that's it. And, you know, at the end when Chakotay is saying, well, that's obviously a manifestation of this, and that could mean something else, and it's very reasonable, and it makes sense. I think Chakotay has this blind spot where it's like, well, what's the worst that Neelix is going to do? Maybe he's going to fuck up lunch, and he's going to have a bad day, and he'll be thinking about this all day, but he'll still be meditating on it, and he'll have some ideas. And then, you know, there's no reason this can't wait for 6 hours. You know, I don't think that I don't think it even occurred to him that Neelix might do something really stupid. And so, again, worst that can happen is lunch is fucked up and we'll deal with it later.
I think that's right, because the other part of that, of course, is that Neelix is not a product of the Federation. He is not a product of Starfleet. He does not have the, you know, emotional, I don't know, intelligence, maybe. He doesn't have the, I mean, I'm not saying he's stupid. It's just he doesn't have the training. He doesn't have the, he didn't grow up in a culture that sort of valued those things. And so he's not, I mean, I don't think it's very likely that a Starfleet personnel would commit suicide necessarily, but they might try, who knows. But I think it didn't occur to Chakotay because to some degree they forget that Neelix is not one of them. He's different from them.
Yeah, which in the one hand is kind of nice because they fully accepted him as one of their own. Like, there is no difference. But on the other hand, you know, and most of the time, you know, that's wonderful. That helps Neelix in his work. That, you know, he's the friendliest guy in the room, and that's, you know, his job, and everybody likes him, and, you know, he's Neelix. And, you know, occasionally a misunderstanding does crop up, like now. I mean, this is a misunderstanding that is just averted at the last second.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, in the Tuvok and Seven watch, because you did like them so much in the Year of Hell two-parter, you know, I did just want to point out their brief little scene in this episode where they talk about mortality and their kind of shared view of it. And really just wanted to mention it because you liked them. And
yes,
seems like the show is not forgetting that, at least.
Yeah, Seven has a couple of really good moments in this. It's not her episode, but she's a very standout secondary character in this way. Number one, we find out the Kazon were not worth assimilating. I mean, that is a pretty horrible thing to say about the Kazon, but I really liked the bit where, Tuvok and she are talking about it, and she's like, well, I'm immortal, you know? The Borg are immortal, you know? And the Borg have my memories, and up to the point where I was cut off, they have my memories, you know? So I'm immortal, and, you know, he's like, oh, that must be a relief, and, you know, just her delivery of, yeah, it is, where it's very distant and cold, and just, you can tell that it's not enough for her anymore, but she's just not showing it. Like, that was one, I really like her performance. I really like the character. I really like the actress. We also find out something that has been on one of my big questions since her introduction, that children assimilated by the Borg are placed in maturation chambers for 17 cycles. So now we learn why there are no children in the Borg, and how child Annika became adult 7 of 9.
There you go.
Yeah,
and it also explains that Borg baby in the tray back in Iborg, not Iborg. Yeah. Sorry, back in Q-Who, I think.
Yeah, the very first one. Yeah.
All right, I think we'll call it an episode. If you have any thoughts on either Concerning Flight or Mortal Coil, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at truckaboutshow.com. You can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/truckaboutshow. It also supports our other podcast, Tuning In, which you can find at tuninginshow.com. In 2 days, we are releasing our episode on The X-Files, Tempest, Fugit, and Max. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you can find us there. Truck About Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an Apple Podcast review for Truck About. It is the best way for new fans to find the show. Next week, we're going to be talking about Waking Moments and Message in a Bottle.